Thank you for listening to When Everything Cracks, a memoir of old San Francisco and the mental health system of yore. Forward by the author. In 1987, I moved from New York City to San Francisco. I had dropped out of Columbia University, and I found a job at this Stud, one of the coolest gay bars I ever knew. While I was working at the Stud, I met a lot of interesting and creative people. I also had the pleasure of being joined by a friend from New York who I called Donnie in this story. He was the most interesting person I had ever met. When we got evicted from our apartment, we had to get this little place on Hyde Street, and it was so small that we each had to sleep in a closet. My closet was the bigger one. I thought he should have had that because he was much taller than me and his feet always stuck out of the little coat closet where he slept. Anyway, this isn't exactly a forward. This is an audio forward. So you can tell that by the informal pauses and the ums and ahs that I'm really just telling you my story. Anyway, what happened was that the Stud decided to move from Folsom Street, where it had been since the 60s, to Harrison Street, where it was for many, many years later. But during that time, I lost my job and I had no money. I had rent to pay. I had no food. And Donnie wasn't able to find work. So we were just kind of in a pickle. It was very different from like retirement or something. There was no savings. There was nothing. So with all that stress, I cracked. And that's what the title of this book is about. It's about when everything cracks, meaning my ability to just be who I am and continue to think properly and think in an order that makes sense. Just, it went away. I lost it. So you'll see the beginnings of that in chapter one, which I'm about to read now. I plan to introduce each chapter in this way with this informal talk before I begin reading. So you'll notice the difference in my voice, but I think you'll enjoy it. All right, so here's book one, 5150, and it's chapter one, Duncan MacLeod. I hear the alarm ringing, but I don't get up. If I wait one whole minute, it will stop ringing and I can stay here. There's a place called home and I'm still looking for it. It's in my dreams and the alarm is taking it away. I don't want to give up looking, nor do I want to go looking for work. I have a great job in the dream. The alarm can't take that away from me. All this week, I felt like there were tiny earthquakes in my bed. Just before I fall asleep, I feel the room shaking. Donnie says it's just my heart beating. We live in a tiny apartment in the Tenderloin. We each take a walk-in closet as our room. Donnie is over 6 feet, so his feet stick out of the closet when he sleeps. Donnie looks like a gargoyle on the ledge of a Gothic church. I love Donnie. He's the most important person in my life. I wouldn't know what to wear, what to smoke, what drugs to do, none of it if I didn't know Donnie. When we smoke pot, we always get the giggles. I have a recording of us on pot. All we do is laugh. We got kicked out for getting the cat's high at our last house, and that's pretty much why we're living in the Tenderloin in this dingy studio. The walls of the apartment are stained with age. The landlord could not blot out the grease and cigarette smoke with mere paint. Mildew creeps through the bone white in strange patterns that are starting to remind me of Tibetan sand paintings. 18-year-olds don't buy furniture. We just pile all our worldly possessions in heaps, which we sort through. The apartment is littered with heaps of clothing. Tufts of fake zebra fur and black leather mark the different piles. Zebra fur is pants, leather is jackets. I don't have a job hunting heap yet. I don't know what to wear to an interview, and I don't know where I want to work. I used to think I wanted to work in a gay bar for the rest of my life. I lied and I said I was 21. Today I don't know what I want to do. I'm meeting Sue for coffee at the cafe floor in an hour, so I'd better get in the shower and find my job hunting clothes somewhere in the heap of nightclub clothes. I love the smell of Aquanet. My hair doesn't look good without a good long spray of white Aquanet, a crimp, and a tease. I can't figure out how to put on makeup, so I usually rely on my natural good looks to get me by. Donnie knows how to put on makeup, not me. I found my black suede creeper, so I'm ready to leave. Donnie is still asleep. I can hear his snores from inside the closet. The Stud closed Friday. I worked there during the last 6 months before the evil transsexual owner of the building evicted the bar so she could open her own bar. The stud had been there for 21 years in an old building that once housed a church called the Universal Life Chorale. The first time I went to the stud, I was 17 years old. Last year. I used the fake ID that I bought in New York to get in. I remember being so nervous that my stomach hurt and I had to go to the bathroom, which wasn't very private. They say the stud was a really sleazy bar in its day, back in the dark ages, during and after Stonewall. But in the 1970s, it became known as the place where the hippies dance with the punks. Now in the 80s, it's just the coolest fucking place on earth. Or it was until last Friday. Now we're all supposed to go down there and help make the new stud, two blocks away, into a great place, for no pay. We're just supposed to volunteer to strip and varnish the whole damn place. No questions asked. Just show up, work, go home, starve. They don't even buy us lunch. I can't live like that. And I know they won't let me work there if I don't do it. If you work at the stud, you're family. Family helps each other out. Some of the creepier members of the family perv on you and tell you that they can get you fired because they know you're not 21, and they're going to tell someone. Family can get you pot and coke for a good price, but they don't have any heroin, never touch the stuff. You have to go to darker, seedier places to find heroin, or so Donnie tells me. I've never tried it. If you sit under the wisteria at the cafe floor, you can usually get away with smoking pot. Sue and I are super stoned. An old man in Oshkosh Bagosh overalls and an engineer's hat shares a toke with us. He has the pot. The crags of his face are lined with a light dusting of dirt. He rides the rails. He tells me how I can catch a train to L.A. from the train yard in Oakland. Sue thinks it's not such a good idea. But there's a whole city down there I've never seen. I don't have any reason to stay here, do I? The stud is closed. They want to enlist me as a slave laborer. How am I supposed to pay my rent in the meantime? Not only do they pay me under the table, but it's also against the law for me to work there. So unemployment is out. Fuck it, I'm going to Hollywood. The engineer says you gotta go early if you want to hop a train. They run all day, but he always has better luck in the morning. You get off at West Oakland and go a few blocks east until you come to where the railroad tracks cross Peralta, and you wait. And when it comes, there are always empty boxcars. Sue is older, more experienced, and very cool. She doesn't have any job ideas for me, but she's going to a seance at Brenda's house. Do I want to go? Yeah, Brenda lives just a few blocks away in the Lower Haight. It used to be an all-black neighborhood, but recently some punks moved in and it's starting to change. Brenda lives in a pink stucco apartment building with aluminum windows, the only modern building on the block. Sue giggles as we enter Brenda's house. Brenda is sprawled out on the peach-colored sofa watching the Prince special on MTV. Brenda is a beautiful buxom blonde from West by God, Virginia, who shrieks when we walk in. Susie, where did you find the fop? He's just a little Lord Fauntleroy of Dickensian foppery on a wheeled stick. This is Duncan, a new inductee to your coven. Sue giggles as she says, coven. Duncan, oh, we're glad to have you. I'm hoping we can get to the bottom of my linoleum mystery. I'm feeling bashful in spite of the fact that I immediately like Brenda. I've never met anyone as smart as Brenda before. She looks at me and asks Sue, where did you find him? Sue just snickers and says, the stud. Brenda grows earnest. Sue, you find so many valuable things at the stud. It's just a treasure trove of gay fabulousness. It turns out that the purpose of the seance is to discover why the bubble in Brenda's kitchen linoleum won't go away. Apparently she's tried everything from nails to hot glue guns, and it just keeps coming up, a sure sign of a haint. Brenda leaves me in the living room while she half flies, half walks into the bedroom, and starts setting up for the seance. Kim follows her in to whisper secret stuff about me. While waiting, I flip through an Aleister Crowley book on Brenda's coffee table called 777. The stuff in there doesn't make any sense at all to me, but it's definitely affecting my mind. The words are coming at me like little men with arrows attacking me. I'm not that stoned. This book is freaky shit. I'm starting to think that maybe it's casting a spell on me, so when I hear Brenda crow like a loon, I gladly put 777 down and run into the bedroom. The seance starts. We turn off the overhead, light the candles, and put the tape recorder on. This reminds me of being 8 years old and talking to Isis on the Ouija board. Brenda calls forth the spirits of the north, south, east, and west winds. She brings sacred healing energy into the space. She then invites a spirit to make itself known. Brenda asks the spirit why she won't let her linoleum lie flat. Nothing. Then she asks the spirit to tell our fortunes. Nothing happens. The candle flickers. At the flicker, Brenda gasps. I realize that the little things, like the flicker of a candle or the slight tremor of a Ouija device, mark contact with the spirit world. Spirits are definitely in the room now. I say, I feel cold. Sue squeezes my hand and giggles reassuringly. Brenda shushes her. I feel unwell, like when you first come down with a cold. We break the circle and the feeling subsides. After the ceremony, we play the tape back. At the highest volume, we can hear a faint voice on the tape, and he sounds terrifying. He's roaring softly like someone in pain on a distant hilltop. Brenda shudders and says she didn't know it was a man that was causing trouble in the kitchen. She says she had pictured an angry black woman. The voice is very faint. We can't make out much of what he's saying except that there's going to be a war and that there will be blood. Then the tape starts to hiss like a snake. Suddenly, Brenda's voice comes through at top volume, scaring me so badly that I nearly pee my pants. Brenda can see I'm not feeling well and hugs me to her bosom in a maternal gesture. "It's okay, Duncan. It's over now." I get up and go watch MTV. It was scary. Brenda comes out to see me on the couch. "We're going to have some champagne. Do you want any?" "Nah, I'm kind of beat." "Well, you just stay perched right there and cluck or squeak if you need anything at all." Brenda glides gracefully into the kitchenette to find a bottle opener. Donnie is awake when I get home. He asks me if he can make a phone call to New Jersey to his parents. I say, "Go ahead, make as many calls as you want because I can't pay it anyway." His boyfriend is in Hawaii right now, so he calls him. They talk for 4 hours while I'm taking a nap. When he gets off the phone, I call my mom in Vermont. She got a copy of my grade report from Columbia and saw all the D's and F's, and she wanted to know if I was doing drugs. I say, "No, of course not, because I don't do drugs." She doesn't believe me. Then I say that if she were working, instead of finding God or Buddha or whatever on the commune in Vermont, then I would have had more time to pay attention to my studies instead of working until 4 a.m. at the milk bar. She says, "Don't hand me that crap." Her voice makes that weird shrieking sound that hurts my stomach whenever I hear it, so I hang up. She calls back and says, "I'm ashamed of you." I say, "Fine," and hang up again. But then I call her back and she's crying. She says it's essential to her that I respect what she's doing because it's the most important thing in her life and should be important to me too. I lie and say it's really important. Good. She's happier. It's time for the evening meditation and she has to get off the phone. Bye. Donnie says, "What the fuck is her problem?" He has never met her, but he doesn't like her. He says, "She's an evil cunt." I get mad and say, "No, she's not." Then he gets out what's left of our little baggie of pot and packs the pipe. We smoke it down to the resin hits. I start to feel that earthquake feeling again, and now I'm not even asleep. Maybe I should lay off the pot after this. I get out a piece of paper and start drawing big, squiggly drawings. The pen never leaves the paper. I just make all the lines run into each other. I draw Donnie and the spider and his ring and the Empire State Building with drugs coming out of the top of it like a needle. I'm bored in San Francisco. I want to go back to New York. Then I remember the guy from Cafe Floor. He was so cool. So I say to Donnie that we should go to L.A. Donnie proclaims, "There's no way we can afford it." I tell him we can hop a train in Oakland. It's really easy, and the guy told me how. Donnie wants to go to L.A., and hopping a freight train sounds cool, but he doesn't think it'll work. "Oh my fucking God, yes it will," I scream. Donnie looks at me like I'm crazy and shrugs. I say, "Let's go tomorrow." Then the giggles hit us bad, and we eat all the bread because we don't have anything else. The resin gives me a headache. I don't have much money except my final pay from the stud, which I'm supposed to get tomorrow morning. That should be enough for a couple of weeks in LA, and we can worry about stuff when we get back. Let's just go and have fun. It's starting to sound so good now, so we're psyched. It's dark out, and I want to go to the underground and dance, but we'll have to scam our way in because I'm flat broke and Donnie hasn't worked since he moved to San Francisco. Let's do it. We put in an extra helping of Aquanet, heat up the crimper, and the house fills with the bitter scent of sizzling hair. Donnie has some Kohl eyeshadow that I want really badly. He puts some on me and says I have to learn how to do my own makeup. While he's putting it on, I try not to look into his eyes because it's embarrassing. The way he puts on my makeup feels good, like I'm being pampered. I love the feeling of his fingers on my skin. Maybe I love him, but he looks like a gargoyle and I want someone who looks like a jock. Then why am I wearing all this makeup and dressing like a skulldagger? It doesn't work, does it? Oh well, at least I'm cool. Donnie calls Lola, and she says she can help us scam our way in. He hangs up the phone and looks at me with a hunger in his eyes that I recognize all too well. It's dope fiend hunger. What? I try to act all innocent. She was fucked up. How can you tell? You just know. Donnie wants some. Well, I have $30 stashed somewhere, and what the hell? I mean, I'm broke when it comes to food, but suddenly I have money for drugs. It's weird. And heroin? I'm afraid.